First bill is Senate President Pro Tem Frederickson Bill number one on the agenda, Senate File 1477. Welcome, Senator, to our committee. I don't think you've been here this year yet, have you?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I think I have. I forget what the bill was, though.
Did we?
Yeah, it was PFA bill.
Oh, did we treat you right that day?
You treated me very well, yes.
Oh, well, let's see if you could go 2 for 2 then, okay. Welcome. Are these your grandchildren over here?
Mr. Chairman, they are.
Oh, stand up. Let's see who you guys are, huh? Yeah, thanks for visiting the Senate.
That's cool.
Don't knock over the chairs. Senator Frederickson.
And Mr. Chairman, what Senate File 1477 would do is allow for a very narrow exception to the very stringent sprinkler code that we have in our building code. And it would allow this exemption at a place called Gilfellin.
Look at this, Jack.
And Mr. Chairman, if you would allow me to give you just a little bit of explanation about the Gilfellin Farm and how it came to be, I think you would find it interesting.
Sure, we'd like that.
In the mid-last century, 1855, 1860, St. Paul was growing and needed a water system. There were several attempts to build a water system, which failed. But in 1868, a private corporation headed by a guy named C.D. Gilfellin put forth plans to build a water system in St. Paul. And on February 7th, 1868, they issued $200,000 worth of bonds and proposed a system that was included 13 miles of mains, airlocks, stop gates, waste and blow-off pipes, and 100 hydrants. And by 1881, St. Paul had grown to 1,800 customers. They had 185 hydrants, and they employed 30 individuals and two different water mains. At that point, the citizens of St. Paul thought, well, this shouldn't be in private hands. It should be a public facility. It should be the city should own the public water system. So they purchased city of St. Paul purchased the water system from the corporation. The primary stockholder was C.D. Gilfellin. And shortly after that, Mr. Gilfellin took largely the proceeds from the sale of that the water system in St. Paul to Redwood County and bought several thousand acres of very, very good farmland between Morgan and Redwood Falls. And that's now known as the Gilfellin Estate. Mr. Gilfellin proceeded to farm it and in later years rented out the land to renters. Ultimately, most of those renters ended up in the 1950s buying the farm. So that's what Gilfellin is, where it originated, and a little bit of the history of Mr. Gilfellin. He was also a state representative, also a state senator, and I'm told was chair at one time of the tax committee. When his son took over his farming operation for him, C.O. Gilfellin, he and his wife Ann had no children. They ended up giving away most of the proceeds of the estate, largely to medical facilities. And when Ann Gilfellin passed away, she, in her will, gave 140 acres and their home to either the Minnesota Historical Society or the Redwood County Historical Society. And Redwood County Historical Society ended up owning the Gilfellin Historic Site. And there's a large, very active Friends of Gilfellin organization that does maintenance and upkeep and providing for the public use of the estate. I'd like to have Ms. Havistol briefly show you some photos of the facility. This is just a display of the farm and the house and museum, and that is a new building that's on. This is on the southwest Minnesota prairie. You can see that on the left. That's how the building site looks from afar. On the right are some of the old buildings that are still there, a couple old barns. There's a water tower in there, some other machine shops, office. Okay, go ahead. This is the building that except for this bill, would require to be sprinkled when there's an addition put on it. It would more than double the size of this building. You can see that it's essentially a picnic shelter. There are garage doors on it that are never locked, that are raised when it's being used. Again, this is another picture of the building from the outside and also from the inside looking out. One of the facilities they would like to put in this new building is restrooms. There are not handicapped accessible restrooms. That restroom sign points to some facilities that are about 500 feet away. And the picture on the right is of the house that was built on this land back in I think about 1872. This is another picture of the old buildings. They give tours of the house. That starts at what once was the business office of the farm. And this is the last picture I was going to show you, another picture of the historic old house. All of the furniture that Mr. and Mrs. Gilfillan used are still in that house. They are maintained and kept up in tours provided by the Friends of Gilfillan. There's some information in your packet about the Gilfillan estate in the longer narrative one. At the back, there are minutes from the Friends of Gilfillan supporting the addition of the picnic shelter, and also from the Redwood County Historical Society supporting putting an addition to this facility. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Al Kolkish, your Redwood County Commissioner, to just very briefly tell you what the project would be, what they have in mind.
Welcome, Commissioner, and for all the witnesses, state your name for the record. So, well, good morning or afternoon.
Al Kolkish, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. And with me today is members of the Gilfillan, about 10 or 12 members of the Gilfillan Board, and many of them volunteers from the board and the organization. Anyway, thank you for the time today. Back in 1998, when this building was built, the group had decided, because of the donation by the Gilfillan estate to the Gilfillan site, to build the tourist business. So back in 98, they built this picnic shelter. We call it a pavilion, but it's a picnic shelter. From a very small scale to last year, the Gilfillan group had over 13,000 tourists come through the historic site of the Gilfillan. All of the volunteers, there's over 100 in the organization. All of them are, it's a nonprofit organization, and all of them are not paid. No one pays, receives a dime for anything. Anyway, the present picnic shelter, pavilion, is 36 feet by 76 feet. It includes a kitchen, which is actually not a kitchen, it's a cooking, a serving counters with refrigerators, freezers, and storage, so there's no cooking done in the facility. The plan is, in the restroom facilities that Senator Fredrickson referred to, are approximately 500 feet from this building. So the plan is to expand this facility, basically doubling the size, pushing out the one wall out to another 48 feet, adding handicap accessible facilities that are on site. So many of the tourists and visitors are elderly, handicapped. Right now they have to go through gravel 500 feet to get to the restroom facilities, and about double the size of the pavilion, the picnic shelter. Expanding the sidewalls, the roll-up gates, the roll-up doors to the full size of the new facility. The as Senator Fredrickson said, the roll-up doors are always open, and the group has been raising funds for the last year or so to put together the expansion or pay for it. It's all funds from fundraising and grants. They have about $150,000 of the $175,000 cost for the new project. Then when we were notified about the sprinkler system, the project basically died. And we don't feel, since there is no heat, the facility is only used during the summer months, every year is beyond from about October through April. The place is not heated. And the roll-up doors are always open, that we are requesting the exemption from the sprinkler system plus sprinkler system that's exposed to the element weather year-round, not heated, would be a major, major maintenance cost. And lastly, the sprinkler system for a new facility would cost in excess of $75,000. So, thank you.
There's a calendar on one of the pages that shows how busy you folks are down there. And you're right, there's no winter months. It's end of March to mid-October, so. And you're not heating the building or, so.
Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, how'd the wedding go for Sarah Wilkerman and Dusty Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, we're told it was a beautiful wedding and a beautiful setting.
Do you know what day it was?
They used a larger picnic shelter.
Well, it was July 19th. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thinking about Nick and him.
Other witnesses, I think it's pretty clear. They very narrow exemption to the building code law. And Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, if there is no opposition, I'd like to move Senate File 1477 be recommended to pass and move to
the floor.
To the floor. And would this be, Mr. Chairman, would this be a candidate for consent?
Yeah, does anybody have any, excuse me, objection to the consent calendar on this one?
Betzel's not on the committee, so I'm saying consent calendar.
Senator Murphy,
okay.
I'm with you.
I think that'll be the motion, and Senator Rosen will make that motion. Thank you. What's the attendance? How many folks you get through here?
Last year, over 13,000.
Oh, that's pretty good. You're close to that casino down there, too, I see.
Mr. Chairman, just one other little piece of information the committee might find interesting. This is right alongside FarmFest.
Oh.
Right to the east is where FarmFest is held.
Now, there's a map. Okay. On the Rosen motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Like Senator Bach, I think he's in the bill.
For liquor
stores. They're here. That's right. No, but Joe Aikens here. Yeah. Oh, that guy. My bill?
Yeah, we're coming back at 6.
Okay, we'll wait about 20 seconds here, Senator. Get these. Okay. Senate File 1476, Senator Box, workers' compensation provisions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And members, just a little refresher. In 1992, the legislature created the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, and we put on that 6 members from the business community, 6 members from organized labor, and their charge was to review potential workers' comp changes to the workers' comp statute and forward those recommendations to the commissioner and the legislature. This bill is a byproduct of that. There's not a lot in here. Most of it's very, very technical stuff. That's why I've asked the department to go through it. I'm still hoping that they can find agreement between labor and management on some other changes, but to date at least, this is the product of their work. And, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say publicly to the commissioner, this is not, the fact that this is workers' comp reform light is no reflection on the commissioner. The commissioner tried very, very hard, set up a number of subcommittees, and there were a lot of meetings held over the interim to try and make some more substantial changes that would have made the system better, and I don't believe compromise the care of the injured worker, but we just weren't able to get there. But I do want to just say he tried very, very hard and spent a lot of the department's resources on trying to come up with something more comprehensive. But for today, at least, this is all we were able to accomplish. So, Mr. Chairman, I could have Ms. Todd from the department kind of walk through what's in here.
I don't know, are there any, I know you've, the commission's been working and meeting very long and hard, and I know there were a couple of issues that we just couldn't get to the goal line on, and not because of the lack of effort on the commission's part or the committee's, your committee's part, but I don't know, are there any, what, do you want to just kind of hit on some of the highlights of the, any major, there are no major changes in here that I could see, and I've looked at this, but why don't you briefly just.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pretty much like you said, there are very little major changes in regard to them. Most of them are technical, and some of them clearly relate to court previous court decisions that were put into the statute in order to make sure that it's clearly articulated there. The first one has to do with the compensation schedule for PPD. It's based on only, right now it's defined only as whole number, so if you have anything that's partial, it doesn't say which way to round up or round down, so we took care of those. As well as there are some changes in two of the entities that help to support the agency. One is the Rehab Review Panel, and the other one is the Medical Service Review Board. Both of the changes.
I think we've got to get your name on the record.
Okay, I'm Patricia Todd, Assistant Commissioner for Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay, thank you.
For both of those areas, we're changing to include or change the membership on the on both of them. And the reason is that we've been unable to fill some of those positions for over 10 years. We're not changing the mix. We're just defining it to be able to broaden it out to be able to include other individuals, but the mix for employee-employer stays the same, as well as we're allowing for electronic means to be able to hold the meetings, but still will require a physical meeting to happen in St. Paul, so physical, you know, so physically people can or cannot attend. In regard to treatment and articles of supplies, we included one thing in here as we and there's a couple of things that are actually included in here that deal with some of the things related to the Department of Health and the governor's initiative to be able to move toward electronic billing and transmission for medical bills, one of them which has to do with whether or not an actual bill gets sent to the employee, and a bill will not be sent to the injured employee unless they have any responsibility to be able to pay for it, as well as and the other ones that are specifically related to that all deal with exactly with transmitting data as well as to be able to be to comply with, like I said, the Department of Health requirements to be able to transmit data electronically. There is an examination. There are certain examinations that were happening in hotel and motel facilities, and we clarified that those could no longer occur there. In regard to overpayments and recovery for overpayments to injured employees, we included what the specific law requires. In regard to insurance and data, there's another section specifically related to that. That deals with the legislative audit reports, November of 2007, which had to deal with the misclassification of employees, and that we needed to share additional information between DEED, DLI, and DOER. So that's to be able to implement those type of things.
I was just looking at that section.
And then also to allow the agency to collect some money that we were not able to collect before from uninsured employers, and to allow for individuals, employers that have a fatality in their workplace to only have to report that fatality once as opposed to twice, and the requirement that a hearing must be held within 2 years unless the chief ALJ decides otherwise, and then to prohibit or stop the subpoena of department staff in regard to dispute resolution systems, which is consistent to what private industry has, and then to remove continuation education for compensation judges because they already have training part of their license. So I know I went through it fast, but as was indicated, it is fairly technical changes.
Why are we removing the continuing education for compensation judges again?
Mr. Chair, it's because right now the judges already are required under their under being a lawyer to maintain and to continue education through that licensure. So there was no need to be able to put it into
Oh, it's a just a duplication of what they have. They have to go back now like other professions for their 20 hours or 30 hours, whatever they do.
Correct.
Okay, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bach, these recommendations have been through the process. They've been through the work comp panel. And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, everything in this bill has been supported by the advisory council. This is their bill.
Okay, let's repeat the makeup of that for the audience. I think it's very important that the audience and everybody knows where the 12-member advisory committee comes from.
Mr. Chairman, there are six members of the business community, six from the labor community that are appointed, and then there are non-voting legislative members on it. I believe there are two from the Senate and two from the House, but they don't
and
have
one Democrat and one Republican. Correct. Is that correct? From the Senate, one Republican and one Democrat from the House.
From both bodies, and the legislation is real clear that none of the appointees can represent attorneys, health care providers, QRCs. So the legislation specifically keeps or prevents people who work in the workers' comp area from being members on the advisory council to try and avoid conflicts of interest as it relates to changes in the workers' comp system. So I've been on it a number of years. It's the only things that get here are things they can find some agreement on. There's a great deal of horse trading goes on. This year, not a lot of trading got done. But I think, you know, I was here in 1995 when we had a very, very contentious workers' comp bill. It barely passed in the House, and I think it passed probably by one vote in the Senate. And I just remember on the House floor, we spent about 8 hours on amendments over there, and I really believe in the council process that, you know, the whole workers' comp system needs to be about the injured worker. And, of course, the costs are important to our employers. And I think proposing changes there in the legislative arena really subjects the whole workers' comp system kind of to the whim of who's ever in control of the legislature at the time, and I don't think it creates enough stability in the system. So I think having labor and management come to the legislature with proposed changes that they both can agree they benefit from keeps it out of, I hate to use this word, but the meddling of the legislature. And it is oftentimes, I think, an awful lot of meddling gets suggested in this system by people that benefit from it in one way or another. And keeping the politics out of the rights of injured workers, I think, is really important because the pendulum does swing back and swung back pretty far in 1995 over the objections of the council. And since then, we haven't taken up additional changes. But I think taking these changes really out of the legislative arena and putting it into a group like this is pretty important.
Very important. So we don't have to wrestle with all this stuff like we did when I first got here and everything came to the House and Senate floor. And
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for a motion on this?
I am ready, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1476 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Okay, any further discussion? Anybody in the audience wish to? I see business and labor folks are in the audience. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just say something more. Senator Sparks has a bill creating a workers' comp ombudsman, and I really think that's a good idea. It was a suggestion from the legislative auditor, and I actually signed on that bill. I want to thank him for giving me an opportunity to be on there. But I need to say something just as a council member. I noticed when I was going back and looking at the statute that created the Workers' Comp Advisory Council and and defines its duties. What it says in part is the advisory council shall advise the department of changes in Chapter 176. The council shall submit its recommendations with respect to amendments to each regular session of the legislature. And here's the part I want the committee to consider. And shall report its views upon any pending bill in a legislative committee. So I think, Senator Sparks, that ombudsman bill, as good an idea as that might be, Mr. Chairman, I think we need to get the advice of the council, because that pretty clearly is what the law says, is that we should seek their advice on bills in front of the legislature. So I think if we're really going to respect that process, I think there's plenty of time to do that. I think we can probably hear that bill and hear what a good idea it is. I think it's a good idea, but I think
this year, Senator.
Well, I think if we can get the council to agree, this Workers' Comp Advisory Council bill could easily be a vehicle for an amendment on the floor, that if that ombudsman's a good idea and the council thinks so, I think there's an opportunity to include it later. But I'm a little nervous about, as much as I think it's a good idea, the law pretty clearly says we should seek their advice on changes. But I think hearing the bill and getting some testimony on it is probably a good idea, but I think the committee would probably be getting a little ahead of itself if we don't get some advice from the members of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council.
And
Senator Murphy.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach brings up a good point, and that's why I asked him if his bill had been through the council. And,
well, I think there. I've heard from a few people this morning that may or not be adding more to Senator Sparks' bill that's really in there. That's what I get out of it. But I think it's not a bad idea, Senator Sparks. We'll hear from you today a little bit and get some testimony, and then.
And I don't know when the council's next meeting is, Mr. Chairman, but you know the commissioner might know. But I think they should have an opportunity to review it probably before the committee takes a vote on it.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and I heard you, but it sort of escaped me when you were reading from the original act. It's not that it was a legislative auditor's recommendation, and I think there's a lot of support for it when we talked about it here, what, a week or two ago.
Yeah.
And I certainly strongly support it. But this isn't, the legislature isn't dependent on that opinion. You just think we should hear what they think about it.
Well, what the law says, it says that the council shall report its views upon any pending bill.
Okay.
So I think they should, at a minimum, they should see it and see and submit to the committee what they think the law says their views are. It doesn't say we're bound by it, but I think we should seek out the law as they're supposed to do that. So. And I support the idea of an ombudsman. I mean, if we can have one for people that are in jails, we certainly can have one for an injured worker, would be my argument.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
And I haven't talked to Senator Sparks about this, so maybe he was just copacetic with this, but I just thought maybe, or it strikes me that maybe we could still pursue his bill and vote on it and still get their opinion. I mean, it's hardly law yet, you know, even if it passes out of here. Because I think it would be good to have that group understand. I mean, maybe I'm misreading the support, but I think there'd be a lot of support for it, and I think it might be good. But I'm just kind of having a conversation with Senator Sparks here.
I could see that.
He's not answering.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I think the bill is more far-reaching, I think, than what the legislative auditor may be recommended.
Okay.
I mean, it suggests that the department supply legal advice to the injured worker. I mean, I don't know if we have that kind of staff over there to do that. I mean, I think it might be a little broader than just giving that injured worker some direction on where to go. So I think it'd be important for the council to take a look at that. And maybe the bill's fine. Maybe they'd suggest some changes.
Because I'm letting them. Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll decide something in a minute.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Sharon, I see you're here. Thank you. Senate File 1189, Senator Sharon. Boiler operators training requirements.
They already do. Tell them their rights. Chair Manson.
happy to present this bill, Senate File 1189, which is about school district boiler operators' training requirements. I'll talk a little bit about the bill, and then we have with us some testifiers who will be able to talk to you about why this is important. The problem that this bill attempts to address is that junior boiler operators are not receiving the kind of on-hands educational experiences with the boilers or the unique characters of boilers in their workplace that are required of them to safely and efficiently operate the boilers in the school districts. What this bill does is require an annual training requirement that will help address this problem by utilizing the knowledge of the senior engineers of the district to train and instruct these junior engineers on safe and efficient operating practices on the boilers that are in those systems. The bill also requires at least 2 hours of hands-on training in the boiler room itself. This will give junior engineers the opportunity to ask questions and learn about the actual boilers they will be operating. There is cost savings to the school districts for the following reasons. The training of the junior engineers to recognize deficiencies early will reduce the maintenance costs, boiler downtime, and prevent costly repairs that will occur if you do not intervene early. It will reduce the time the senior engineers need to spend in the boiler room because the junior engineers will be able to recognize safety problems and efficient operating practices. There have been deficiencies that have been documented by the state boiler inspectors over the past year that should have been recognized and documented or corrected by junior engineers, and they include such things as small leaks in the steam and hot water systems that reduce efficiency and allow oxygen and non-condensable gases into the system. Boiler controls that were not tested regularly or being tested incorrectly. These are noted by the state boiler inspector that the boiler water chemistry is not being monitored correctly. And this results in costly chemicals either being wasted from over-treating it or not enough chemicals being added to protect the boiler from corrosion. And finally, it was noted the documentation of boiler pressures and temperatures were not interpretable, and these readings were not done properly to evaluate boiler safety and efficiency. So this bill asks the school districts to provide an annual training program. I'd like to offer some testimony, if that would be correct at this time. I'd like to introduce Don Morrell. He's an SEIU member and from the Anoka-Hennepin School District.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you guys about this.
Don Morrell, right?
Don Morrell is my name. I work for Fredmore Middle School and Anoka-Hennepin School District 11. When I started with the school district 4 years ago, I was hired, and nobody ever mentioned anything about boiler license and stuff. Well, as I started doing my job, my boss came up and said, "Don, you need to start working towards getting your licenses to become a boiler operator." And I said, "Sounds like a great idea. Where can I start?" Well, when I went to the district and asked them for training, they had no training. What we got was just a book. And he said, "Go ahead and read it, and that should get you by. It's going to be all about safety." Well, that got me through my specials, but it wasn't all about safety. It took a little bit of knowledge, and I had a really good lead guy that helped me out when I asked him to show me some things in the boiler room at that time. He's no longer with us, though. But anyways, from there, you go on to get your second license, and when this all started, I also wanted to become a steward. And when I became a steward, this was a goal of mine to try to get us training in our districts. And so, you know, in a way, it was also a financial thing that I thought, here we have to pay for our own training through classes that were anywhere, at that time, $200 to $300. Well, now they're up to $500 to $1,000 for training in these classes if we want to take that. And then you pay for your own books, which I did, and that cost me another $500, and you pay for your licenses to go take the test. So it became a financial burden to me at the time. And I started talking to Joel Amato from the Department of Labor, and we got to discuss some of this issue. And Joel came up with some good ideas about this bill on how we should work together on setting out something so our districts can train us and go forth. And in the end, it became more of a safety issue as I started looking at it, too. It wasn't so much, I mean, financial is there, but it is true, like Senator was saying about the schools, they're not being maintained properly as far as the boiler operators when it comes down to training. We need to get in the boiler room so we know what's going on and be able to detect things sooner. It's also going to be cost efficient for everybody. And on that, I'll have Allie Anderson speak. She's also an SEIU union steward, and she works for the district. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alicia Anderson. I'm also a custodian for Anoka Hennepin School District. I work at Champlain Park High School. Having qualified operators is going to be a significant cost savings to school districts. Having qualified operators, we're going to be able to recognize and fix problems sooner, faster, which will likely reduce maintenance and energy costs. The cost of heating in Minnesota, even the detection of a small leak in any one of our systems could be tens of thousands of dollars in savings to school districts. We're asking that the 2 hours of boiler room training, which is specific to each one of our buildings, that we're going to have the hands-on knowledge, each of us, to what we're comfortable with and looking at in our boiler rooms. The qualified operators, it's going to make it a much safer operating environment for our boilers. The cost savings of knowing and detecting it earlier. Thank you.
Sir. You.
Oh, I'm,
yeah.
I'm
oh, you're the answer question guy.
Excuse me, Chair. Can I say one more thing? Because I wanted to mention this.
Sure,
it,
you.
It was something that we, when I became a steward and met other district and union members, I found out this is district-wide throughout our state. And so we got support from our union members, but also we did go to the districts. We talked to the principals, teachers, our bosses, and they were all in support of this, too. And that was the other really neat thing that I like about this is we don't see where this should cost the district any amount of money because this is just training we should be having anyways. And we could do that on days where kids aren't in the school, you know, a couple hours here and a couple hours there. So it's not something that's going to draw money from the school districts. Hardly, I don't see at all. And that's where I feel really good about it because I know how tough times are here for everybody, and it's a good bill for everybody.
Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bonner?
Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you for bringing it forward, Senator Sharon, and I appreciate your comments, but I'm wondering, is there a fiscal note? I would assume if there's a training, there would have to be an expense for providing the training.
No, we don't have to.
Mr. Sure. Chair, Josh Whitney Wise with SEIU. No, the bill says that the training is administered during work hours. So basically like 15 minutes during a shift a week, you go into the boiler room. You have your checkoff list that the Department of Labor is providing and you do it. It's all done during work time. And also the people who are administering the training, the first and the chief's engineers, get that training credit for teaching the junior engineers.
And Mr. Chair, I would
that
the bill would go to education also?
The Education Committee has requested this bill. Senator Scheid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand it would be somebody who's licensed in the cost you were talking about earlier, I guess I should back up. Mr. Morrell, was the cost for the licensing?
Yes.
And so the training is done kind of in-house. It's just, okay, so then I understand better. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, what we're hoping is that this will alleviate the cost on the members from not having to take the $500 class at, you know, Anoka Tech Community College or Kenwood.
Well, should save money.
Yeah, it should save money, yeah.
Well, that's what we're all about here lately.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, forgive me. So will they still be licensed, though? I mean, Subdivision 1 requires license. So they'll still have to take those classes to get licensed.
Mm-hmm.
They'll still have to pay for those classes, or no?
They'll have to pay for the test. But the classes are prep for the test. The test is administered through the state, and then those classes are just through the community colleges that help them along their way.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, to sit for a test, either for a special or second class, first class, chiefs, and it doesn't matter if it's an A grade or a B grade, you have to have so much time on the job site. You know, the training that they're talking about at the technical college is so that when you do sit for the test, you pass. It's not a requirement. The requirement is you have to have so much time working with the piece of equipment that you're going to be tested on. And that's the way it is, whether it's a special or a second or a first class or a chief's boiler's license.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Sharon.
I would like to just thank you, Senator. I would like to just affirm that that's the critical issue, that the preparatory course for the exam is for taking the exam. But what the chief, actually Joel Amato is here from the Department of Labor, could talk about what he finds when he goes to do the inspections is that this what would be helpful is if they had some hands-on experience, because the learning and the test, testing to the learning to the test is not translating into actual capacity to do the job. So they're finding these problems that could easily be better resolved, less costly to the school district, less costly to the department, if we provided this kind of hands-on, kind of a clinical, I'd call it.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, you're exactly right, because what I found is that just about anybody can go to those classes, and they're not only at some of our technical schools out here, but there's some other trade schools that offer these. And you can sit for the test, and you'd be able to pass the test. But when you go out to look at one of these boilers, and it doesn't matter if it's a low-pressure system or a high-pressure system, most of those people that pass the tests that don't have the hands-on experience, they wouldn't be able to tell you where the safety valve is. They wouldn't tell you where, be able to tell you where any cutoff switches were. They're basically worthless. And hands-on training in this field makes all the difference in the world.
And that's what the bill... Yeah. Senator Murphy specifies, so yeah, I think you're right on, Senator Sharon. And
I think this is a good piece of legislation, and as
Senator
long as
Rosen.
The school districts can afford to,
they're
going to have a little bit of money invested in this, but I think that the testifiers are right. In the long run, you know, it's going to pay off, because you're not going to have to fill up your system all the time with more glycol or whatever your moderator is. Worry about it blowing up because somebody gagged the safety valve and forgot to check it off. You're going to have experienced people that know their machinery, and this is a good bill. We should just pass it and move on.
Well, is that in the form of
Mr. Chairman, I'd move it then.
I think Senator Murphy should move it. He gave the longest speech. Senator Scheid, any further discussion? Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say that Senator Sharon has been working in the world of boiler operators for a while, and she knows a lot about this, but compared to Senator Murphy, I don't know quite. Maybe you're up to as far, but if you're ready for a motion, I was going to move the bill. So.
Okay, Senator Rosen moves it. Apparently education does want to see it, so that'll be part of your motion to refer it to Education Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you much, guys.
Everybody,
I can say in terms of Senator Rosen's comment, maybe I could pass the test, but you wouldn't want me in your boiler room.
I don't want to be in your school that you inspect, I'll tell you that. Senator Sparks, you've got some people here from out of town. This is obviously a little bit of what we talked about with Senator Bach's bill, so we refresh our memory there. Senate File 1423, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for taking time to hear this very important bill. Senate File 1423, and as Senator Scheid alluded to a little bit earlier, a few weeks ago we had a big presentation from the legislative auditor on oversight of workers' compensation. I believe in your handouts you'll find the major findings and the key recommendations from that report. And before we get started, I just want to thank Mr. Fuller and Council. I know that he's done a lot of work. Our staff people are very busy, but I know there's been some miscommunication. We're going to try to clear some of that up today as we move forward. But one of the key recommendations that the legislative auditor said that the legislature should establish an ombudsperson for workers' compensation. I have nothing against the advisory council, and I respect Senator Bach and the work that he and his colleagues have done. However, I think even in his remarks, he said that their provisions were light this legislative session. And again, in the key recommendations, it says the legislature should establish, not the advisory council. I think that Senator Bach is correct in saying that we need to make sure that we protect injured workers, and that's exactly what the legislation that's in front of you is going to try to do. The legislature has established these positions in Minnesota and many other programs, including taxpayer rights advocate, managed health care programs, mental health and development disabilities, and most recently, the Department of Transportation commissioner was an Albert Lee, and one of the first things he did, he came into a department that Senator Murphy, to say the least, had a lot of issues, and one of his first initiatives was to have a ombudsman put into the Department of Transportation. So you can see that there is precedent, and we have done that in many other areas. The recommendations continue to go on to say, we recommend that the legislature establish a similar position specific for workers' compensation. As in other programs, we would expect an ombudsperson for injured workers to provide a fresh look at claimants, individual situations, problem solve, and suggest options to claimants' dilemmas. That person would provide a separate avenue for injured workers who want assistance focused on their point of view. The intent of this bill is to help citizens who are injured and to navigate a complex and delay-prone system into which the law requires them to go into if they are injured at work. And Mr. Chair, with me today, I do have an injured worker with me that would like to tell you some of the stories and some of the problems that she had through the system. I also, in the audience, we have a wife of an injured worker who was recently injured, actually is laying in a hospital bed here in the Twin Cities with 40% burns over his entire body. And so the idea behind this legislation really is to try to find a person who would help these injured workers who are overwhelmed within the workers' compensation process. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Dee Dee Morrison to explain a little bit about the process and her story, if that's okay with you.
It's okay with me. Welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Hi, my name is Dee Dee Morrison. I was injured. My first injury was in November of 93. After a surgery, a skin graft, I was on light duty. I was told by my surgeon to get a QRC. I didn't know what a QRC was. I went to my employer, told him I was supposed to get a QRC. They said that we don't appoint a QRCs. We take care of you within the house. They kept me on light duty jobs. I ended up having surgery again on my wrist in 1995. Light duty job wasn't working. I didn't have a QRC, nobody to go to. In 97, I ended up having surgery again on my wrist, which is fused. In the meantime, I was still dealing with a torn shoulder, which I couldn't get proper medical care for because they were treating me in-house. When I finally did get a QRC, I had so much paperwork. I had no idea where to go, what to do. I got a hold of a lawyer. The process was just overwhelming, just overwhelming. And in November of 2005, I was off of work because of my injuries. I went back in May of 2006, told my employer that I could not, I was coming back to work, but I had to go within my restrictions. They told me to go home, told me they didn't have a job within my restrictions. I had no pay from April 25th until my case was settled with permanent total disability in... We went to court in February of 2008. The process, it just kept getting delayed. I didn't know where to go. You cannot know, there was no financial help, no guidance to anybody helping you. emotionally, I mean, financially, if I didn't have my husband, I would have lost everything.
You had a lawyer, didn't you, at this point?
I did, but it kept getting delayed.
How would this legislation help you somehow up front, maybe?
I'm sure it would. Yes, I'm sure it would, you know, because if you'd have somebody to talk to. I mean, I end up with therapy and antidepressants and because there was nowhere to go.
Okay. Okay, any further testimony? Anybody in the audience wish to speak in favor or against this legislation? I'm just... Shalito, do you wish to be heard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Leto, Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And certainly I've since I was staff in the House for the Labor Management Committee for 10 years, dealt with this issue for a total of 14 years from 1983 through 1995, and unfortunately on the losing side on most of those provisions that passed into law. I've been with the AFL-CIO for 9 years, and I can tell you from Ms. Morrison's comments that I must have talked to between 500 and 1,000 people over the years that have had the same types of situations. Having said that, the advisory council has not seen this provision. It was mentioned by the legislative auditor on the day that the bill that you passed separately by Senator, or just a minute ago by Senator Bach, when we were doing passing those recommendations, that was the day that we heard about the ombudsperson from the legislative auditor. So I guess at this point, and in fact, I know there's other dispute resolution language the auditor talked about that should be done as well. We saw that provision by basically 2 weeks prior to, and I was not able to get the six people on the advisory council together because of the legislature and everything else going on, obviously. So I guess at this point we'd have a desire to look at this, try and put it together for next year. I don't know if it could be done for this session, I'll be honest with you. And the other thing is part of this is we have, I mean, I think some, I certainly respect Senator Sparks and I know in the House, Representative Mahoney for bringing this forward, but part of the problem, I mean, it's, and I mean no disrespect to the current commissioner whatsoever, but any commissioner, Democrat, Republican, or independent, that appoints somebody within the workers' comp system after having dealt with this for so many years, we have a concern about. If there's some way to do it independently, looking in, we would prefer that. I know there are some ombuds people that do that. We would certainly prefer that. And the other part of it is certainly having somebody provide legal advice can be a little... It may be good, but it could be a little dangerous as well. You know, and I don't know if some of, and I don't know enough about some of the ombuds people to know if they provide legal advice. I mean, I just don't know. So that's, I guess, our concerns. The advisory council process can, believe me, can be frustrating. Having served as an alternate for a number of years to President Ray Waldron, it can be very frustrating, but at the same time, I also remember all of the battles that that were fought here over the years, and that was not good for injured workers, in my opinion. So, I mean, or for businesses, for that matter. So.
Leto, this is carried by Mr. Senator Sparks, but it did come out of the legislative audit
correct
report, and I sit on that committee, and very impartial, very thorough. Mr. Nobles and that group, and I, if it makes sense, I don't know why you have to wait a year to do this. I mean, I know you people are busy, but there's 12 of yous, and if this is important, which I think it is, why can't, I don't know if you want to wait a year, or why we should wait a year. Hear it? If it's not a good idea, we won't do it, but I think we ought to I'm changing my attitude here. I think we ought to move ahead with this thing. And
Mr. Chair,
I don't want to wait a year if it's.
I would say, I mean, if the, you know, if the legislature would like to look at a number of these, you know, ideas that, you know, it's perhaps the, you know, perhaps the advisory council has outlived its usefulness. I don't know.
You guys are doing a good job. Do you take the heavy lifting away from us, which is good? We appreciate it. We're not cutting.
Right. No. But I'd say, Mr. Chair, if there was a way to do it at an independent basis, there's a lot of stuff in the auditor's report. There was things that the department is not doing that they said the department is not doing right now. I think perhaps we should look at all of those things, and I'm not sure that it's, you know, feasible to do it in the next 2 weeks. But
Senator Scheid, then Senator Boniff.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would like to see this go forward because I think it's so important to injured workers, and I appreciate and I respect where Mr. Leto is coming from. I understand the concern about who this person might be, but I think the legislature can always step in down the road if we see that, you know, they're not a proponent. I mean, I think the charge would be, and I think this commissioner would take very seriously, that this person would be for injured workers and not, and I think that we make that very clear, and I'm sure that that's what he would want to do. But in the event that somebody wasn't acting to a degree that we felt really helped people, then I think the legislature could step in. But I think it's important enough to get it going and at least get the department to, you know, maybe give us some idea. And I don't know if the department's is scheduled to testify or not. I don't know, Madam Chair, we can just see, but it would be interesting to hear what their take is on it.
Perhaps if we could have a question from Senator Koch, and then we do have someone else at the table as well, and Senator Bonoff. Senator Koch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just to Senator Sparks, seat you over again, because I'm not super familiar with the history of ombudspersons, but you mentioned that the department, the DOT, just recently appointed an ombudsperson, and you did that without even legislative authority, and then and the commissioner appointed, or how was that person brought about?
Madam Chair and Senator Koch, I'm not exactly sure. All I know is that the new commissioner was in Albert Lea with our District 6 manager. I can get some more information. Maybe if...
Madam Chair, I know. So we have Senator Boniff has a
Madam
a
Chair
response.
And Senator Koch, yes, the commissioner did recently appoint an ombudsman and did that because of getting some concerns from just community members at large as well as legislators that when citizens had complaints that they weren't being taken seriously and that the commissioner felt that there was a need to have somebody to represent those people. And so I was actually going to address Senator Sparks' bill as well because I think it is an important bill. I think Mr. Leto brings an important point. I think that this would be a positive step, but when you talk about the legal provisions shall provide legal advice, I'm not certain that that is what you want your ombudsman to do because then what are the liabilities that ombudsman is taking on to provide legal counsel? And so I might suggest that you play with the words a little bit because generally, an ombudsman is more a spokesperson, sort of a mediator between two entities and can represent the concerns and help solve disputes. But I would not think we would want our ombudsman to be providing legal advice to the worker because that goes into a different area.
So on that point, Senator Boniff, right now the language stricken in 1.18, perhaps Mr. Fuller could address that. That may be something that we are already doing in current law.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Boniff, members, current law in two places refers to, I'll read the law because it reads, prior to advising employee or employer to seek assistance outside of the department must refer employees and employers and employers seeking advice or requesting assistance in resolving dispute to an attorney or other technical paraprofessional, professional workers' compensation division employer, whichever is appropriate. So under current law, there is this notion that the commissioner can refer people to legal advice. So this bill focuses a little more clearly.
But Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I apologize. Madam Chair and Mr. Fuller, exactly, the law in current statute, it says by an attorney at law, and we are not stipulating that the ombudsman would be an attorney. And so I still would stand by that the role of the ombudsman would not be to take the place of getting legal counsel, which I don't think we want our ombudsman put in that position. I would think we want our ombudsman to be more of a neutral person helping represent the injured worker.
So, Senator Scheid, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, on that point, I wonder also about legal, unless we're going to require that the person be an attorney, which isn't all that far out there in terms of thinking. But right now, current law says that the commissioner, may designate one or more of the division employees to advise that party of rights under this chapter, which is similar to legal advice. But I think you might be able to take out legal and just leave technical and other advice concerning rights and obligations, and think about where I think Senator Bonhoff is right about. I don't think you want them giving legal advice if they're not an attorney. I'd like to see somebody who had worked in the system representing people or was a judge or something like that being the person who can, you know, really help people, because I think they are to be an advocate for the person. And right now, I mean, the department arguably could be doing something like this. But and the only other question I would have, well, I'd like to see that people know of this when they're injured. So it says when requested by an employer or an employee, or an employee is dependent, but maybe there should be, you maybe shouldn't have to wait for that request. When you have an injured worker, you should show them you have this right to go to this person. I'm just thinking of maybe adding that, and I don't have language for you, but I think, Senator Sparks, you might want to take legal out in any case. So on line 12.
So, Senator Michelle, would you like to add to this conversation?
Well, I would.
So please do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It just strikes me, members, that as we dive into the details, that this is exactly the kind of conversation and bill drafting and interpreting that we want to get out of the advisory council. I mean, that's why you guys exist. And so I'm left with wondering if Senator Sparks, if you could, you know, send an all-points bulletin over to the WCAC and say that you have a legislative committee that's ready to go, but we would like their counsel and recommendation.
Madam Chair and Senator Michelle.
Senator Sparks.
I would like to do that. However, I think while the council does do a lot of good things, I think if we think about, I have a lot of friends in labor, but we put six labor people on this side, and I have a lot of friends in business. We put six business people on this side. Senator Bach even said in his opening remarks that this is workers' comp light. I know it's there for a reason that we don't want to fight this out, but let me just give you like one example that was in Senator Bach's advisory council recommendations for this year. The Office of Administrative Hearings is given 26 months to schedule a hearing. So if you have an injured worker over here and they have 26 months before they even have to schedule a hearing for that person, is that really fair to that injured worker? In the meantime, they don't receive any benefits?
And they don't know.
And they don't know what's going to happen to them. That's all I'm saying. I like the advisory council. I think that we're just trying to prove how important this is. The legislator auditor recommended that we do it. And maybe we can. Maybe this is a point to say workers' comp advisory council. Let's see if we can't get this in place and get it worked out.
So there's been discussion about possibly deleting the word legal, but we do have someone else at the table. I wonder if you'd like to add your testimony as well. I think we're having a discussion here. I'd like to just continue a little bit longer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeremy Essenson with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. David Olson, also my boss, sits on the advisory council. I'm just here to echo and support what Mr. Leto said. And maybe to Senator Michelle's point, our hope is that the Work Comp Advisory Council is able to get together, have the stakeholders discuss concerns, which haven't necessarily all even been identified yet, and then bring any findings to you folks before the bill moves forward.
Okay, thank you. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, and for both Chamber and Labor, Senator Bach just passed a bill that came from your recommendation. You have a rehabilitation review panel, and you have a medical services review board. And in both cases, you allow them to attend meetings by telephone. And it would seem to me you guys could round robin the group and ask them if it's okay if an ombudsman is something that you would like to recommend in the very near future. And while we pass this thing out of here, you could ask all the members, since the commissioner of the department seems to think it's a good idea, labor seems to think it's a good idea, business seems to think it's a good idea, we all seem to think it's a good idea, and the legislative auditor thinks it's a good idea. It seems pretty easy to find out what the sense of the council would be before you have a meeting. And if we were to pass this out of here and wait until we actually hear from you guys, it would you have a telephone recommendations right in the bill that we just passed. So I think that taking legal out is probably a good idea, and moving the bill forward and then waiting for a recommendation from you guys is probably a good way to go.
Madam Chair, if I might. Senator Tomasoni and some of the other comments made, certainly we could do that. But if that's the way we want to go with most of the provisions, that's perfectly fine. I do want to, maybe the department wants to say something. I actually do on the 26 months that came from the department, and we questioned, both business and labor questioned, in fact, that right now the Office of Administrative Hearings does not take nearly that long to hear a case. Prior to 1983, actually, they did take anywhere from 18 to 24 months to get a case heard. That has now dropped under, I mean, that Chief Judge, I don't believe, is here, but I'm sure it's under 12 months. And these are your most disputed cases. These are not, as the auditor mentioned in his report, 87% of cases basically are solved with little or no problem. 13% are. An ombudsperson may well help. They're probably not going to be able to solve most of those 13% of the cases, because those are the most disputed of disputed cases. The other thing that I do want to mention is the department for years and years have had personnel at the department to answer questions from injured workers. If that injured workers, I believe those personnel are still there, but if they're not doing that, then I have a question as well on that.
So is the department here that we could hear from them?
Hello, I'm Patricia Todd, the Assistant Commissioner for Workers' Compensation.
Thank you very much for being here, Ms. Todd.
I can answer a few of the questions that have been brought forth. One has to do with information that is sent to the injured worker. Right now, every injured worker receives a written pamphlet from the Department of Labor and Industry, which explains their rights, which, you know, depending on what level you want to read at, and if you want to go through five pages, you know, it is somewhat complicated. But as one of the things that the commissioner is working on is to be able to develop a DVD, which will hopefully be done by the end of this summer, which would also be available to an injured worker as well as to employers who have injured workers to get a general overview of how the system works. As well as we're looking at utilizing that same DVD to put it online, so that way people can just look at little snippets to be able to find out what specifically happens within the system. As Mr. Leto indicated, we still dedicate a great deal of our staff to answer the phones. We have individuals who are our most senior staff who, when they answer the phones, they try to resolve the issues as much as possible on the phone. If an injured worker calls up and expresses a concern about a specific insurer or employer, the staff will actually call that insurer and employer and try to work it out. so an official dispute does not happen. And we have 12 staff who do that, as well as they do mediations and arbitrations, and, well, not arbitrations, mediations, conferences, and other things to be able to resolve some of the these disputes earlier in the process.
So at this point, Senator Tomasoni, did you want to move to remove the word legal on line 1.13? And Senator Sparks, would you like to respond to that? Or is that, I think I heard some suggestions to that effect.
Senator Sparks, I suppose the motion would be shall be legal and change or to and. Advice concerning rights, or and
I would say just shall provide advice. Think that you want to leave the word and in. So on that motion,
Madam Chair, and strike the comma, or did you say that?
Yeah. Okay. So,
could you repeat it for us here?
Right. So the motion would be shall provide. So we would strike the word legal, comma, and it would be shall provide technical. Remove the other comma and other advice concerning rights and obligations. And is there further discussion on the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Same sign, opposed. And the motion passes. Okay, Senator Sparks, what would you like to do with the bill?
Well, Madam Chair, obviously it's up to the committee. I would like to keep the discussion going. I think that, we'll continue to work with the individual parties. I think the big thing to remember with this bill is not a substantive change in benefits, but rather more a reorganization proposal.
Cost money.
And so maybe that we can have the council move quickly, and we'll give them some time to talk and maybe come back with some recommendations. But I would.
There's been some discussion about further conversations with the advisory council, and how could that take place? I think this is going to the floor, so that would be a question of where that discussion would take place if there were any changes.
Fuller, is there any impact to this bill? Senator Sparks, have you heard that there's a fiscal impact?
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Tomasoni, depending on how broad one would read this, it has definite financial impact in regard to it. If it's just an ombudsperson, that would be by far less than the way it's written now. It could be fairly broad, and it would, now that legal's out of there, that helps to narrow it down. But yes, there would clearly be a fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, then we can ask for a fiscal note. We could send it to Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Sparks, that's a very good idea. So, Senator Tomasoni, you would like to see this, so we would move this bill to finance. So, is that?
I think
do I hear that people generally believe that that would be a good move at this point to have continued discussion on the topic, Senator Tomasoni?
No, I just. Cost some money, but I would think the workers' comp funded. In that big picture of life, it's you couldn't even see this really.
Madam Chair,
but that is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator. Again, it depends on the scope of how you interpret this language.
We'll do it to that scope.
Well, if we do it to the scope that, and I think the recommendations and the agency's continual recommendation is that we clearly support the Work Comp Advisory Council. And I do clearly, we clearly respect what their role is. And I think that from a bill perspective and from as we move things like this forward, it would be an opportunity for the Work Comp Advisory Council to work together to potentially bring forth something and to be able to meet on that within the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Senator Scheid had a question.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say it seems to me for the benefit, I guess, of the council, and that is I think that it's – I mean, I haven't heard anybody here say they weren't in favor of this. I feel pretty strongly in favor of it. It sounds like others who have spoken do as well. So I think advice would be really helpful in terms of how it should be structured, but that the legislature – at least I think this committee wants us to move forward.
So does it need to go to Finance, Senator Tomasoni?
Madam Chair, I think we should just take a look at it there just because we want to hear from the council. And
very
plus,
good. That's
plus,
a good idea. So, Senator Sparks, I think we're ready to move your bill, and the motion is to move the bill and refer it to Finance.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended. As amended. So all those in favor of moving Senate File 1423 to Finance as amended, please say aye.
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 And opposed, same sign.
No.
And the motion prevails.
Who said no?
Thank you
very much, Senator Sparks. And next is Senator Tomasoni with Plumbing Continuing Education Modification, Senate File 1273. That was good discussion, committee. Thank you for your thoughts and good feedback. And Senator Tomasoni, welcome.
Thank you.
And
thank you,
I understand
Chair.
You have with you, is this Mr. Johnson? This is Mr. Thaden. Very good.
Mr. Thaden.
This is about half of Mr. Johnson. Based
on very good. I see. I didn't see the first name, but
I don't think he heard that.
Very much.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate File 1273 is simply a bill that allows the plumbing board to give continuing education to plumbers and pipe fitters, and I think that's all it does. So if you want to add to that, go ahead.
So Mr.
This is Gary Thaden,
Thaden,
I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. And we support this legislation. It deals only with plumbers, does not deal with pipe fitters. Electrical industry a number of years ago put in continuing education into their process. The plumbers do not have that. The plumbing industry would like to model what the electricians do. Right now there are about 82 providers of continuing education for electricians. We anticipate that there'll be a similar number in the plumbing industry. They give classes throughout the state. There are apprenticeship committees. There are contractor associations. There are unions. There are private providers. There are state educational institutions who all provide electrical continuing education. We anticipate the same thing will happen with the plumbing industry.
Very good. And Mr. Johnson, would you like to provide any some testimony as well? Thank you.
See what I meant now.
We have all three at the table. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Johnson, and I represent the Minnesota Pipe Trades, including the plumbers, and we support this legislation.
Are there any questions for Senator Tomasoni? This is wonderful to have everyone on board. And I'm wondering, Senator Tomasoni, we were just talking at the table, if maybe we want to hear Senator Metzen's bill and it could be amended onto yours.
That'd be fine.
Senator Metzen, let's just have Senator Metzen come to the table before we pass this bill and hear Senate File 1425. Excuse me, 1272.
Yeah, I think this is the same.
That's right.
Section of the law that would fit right in here. And maybe Mr. Joachim, the department brought it forward, that deals with the master journeyman and for plumbers and documented practical plumbing experience 5 years worth. And maybe you could add a little to that.
Yes, welcome.
Madam Chair, Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. We have multiple licenses within the agency for our staff that requires them to maintain the license that they are inspecting for the program. We have boiler licenses, pressure piping, and electrical licenses. If they're in that field, they have to maintain that license to do the inspections. This does the same thing for plumbing. It requires that our plumbing inspectors have a plumbing license if they're going to be inspecting plumbing. All of our job descriptions already require that, so this isn't any different than what we're currently doing. Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members?
So I understand the amendment would be to insert the language in Senate File 1272 into Senate File 1273 in the appropriate sections.
That would be my understanding.
Madam Chair, that I will make that motion.
Senator Tomasoni makes that a motion to insert the language in Senate File 1272 into 1273. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate File 1273 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor.
Very good. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Senator Skoy? Senator Skoy, we now have Senate File 1425, which is grain elevators exclusion from construction code regulations.
And Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
Thank you. We so could.
First stop for this bill, so if I could deal with this as an author's amendment.
And would you like to start explaining your amendment while it's being passed out, Senator Skoy? Then we can.
Well, yes, I can, Madam Chair. I was hoping to just deal with it as an author's amendment.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so Senator Skoy moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed,
aye.
Same sign, and the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1452 is a bill that deals with man lifts at county elevators. In 2007, the legislature had a major update of the elevator and the escalator regulations. And I think that there was, I don't know if it was intentional or unintentional, but there certainly was some consequences that weren't probably anticipated, one of which was that all the man lifts in rural elevators became subject to the same requirements as all other public elevators. I think that the department will come and testify that they probably don't have the staff to regulate all of those elevators. It certainly is not a very good situation for all of these country elevators to be dealing with. I've got Mr. My name here, Zelka, with me today from the Grain and Feed Association, who would like to give some more meat on this bone. But the amendment that I offered is as the bill was originally drafted, we were just planning on removing these man lifts from the effects of the regulation changes of 2007. What the amendment does is has the department put a task force together to study regulations of elevators and man lifts in these facilities, and what my commitment is to the department, to the industry, and to the committee that next year after the task force reports back that I would carry appropriate legislation with regard to what regulation is needed. And I think if Mr. Zelka could just say a few words about the impacts on the county elevators, and Mr. Joachim is here from the department also.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. And just introduce yourself. And Senator Skoy, one more thing.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just brought to my attention, I do have one small oral amendment that I'd forgotten about. On page 1, line 13, after elevators, if I could insert and feed mills.
Is there any discussion on that amendment? And all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. And Mr. Fuller has one other suggestion for you, Senator Skoy.
Probably should make the whole bill effective immediately. So on the amendment on line 12, instead of section 1, we'll say sections 1 and 2R, just so they have authority to get up and running with that task force.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. I'd make that as an amendment also.
Very good. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign, and the motion prevails. Senator Skoy, and we have with us
Mr. Zelka.
Mr.
Zelenka.
Thank you very much for being here today.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We represent grain elevators and feed mills in the state of Minnesota. We have facilities in over 600 communities around the state. We provide permanent employment for over 11,000 people, and we pay over about $85 million in taxes annually. So it's a fairly substantial industry that a lot of people aren't that familiar with. But we play a key role in rural Minnesota. 2 years ago, a bill was passed to address some issues with the passenger elevators and escalators. And it was about a 300-page bill. About a page and a half of that sort of drew us into this. Grain elevators have what's called a man lift. It's a single-person caged unit, if you will, that's used sparingly to do maintenance on the elevator to make it easier than taking a ladder upstairs. And it's 80% of the elevators have what's called a rope pole man lift. It's a manual mechanical, not an electrical man lift. But they work very, very well. They have for years. We do have an existing OSHA regulation that regulates the maintenance and operation of those man lifts already. And this was sort of a duplication, if you will, onto an already existing regulation. So now we have two divisions at Labor and Industry essentially enforcing man lift regulations at a grain elevator and a feed mill. There are other elements of this. I won't go into any detail, but long story short, there seems to be some additional costs, unnecessary paperwork, unnecessary requirements, and unrealistic expectations for inspections that are contained in that language. So we're looking for an exemption from what was contained in the 2007 legislation, but we also have had conversations with the department about their concerns and about taking a closer look at this as time goes on per the amendment. I think that was passed around.
Good. And Mr. Joachim, would you like to add to that?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, thank you. As a process here, I'm going to address the amendment, and that's what we helped craft here to address this because we were concerned also. As some of our inspectors were out inspecting these, we found issues that our annual maintenance inspections maybe shouldn't apply the same to these as we would to a passenger elevator that's used by the public, and that wasn't addressed in that bill in 2007. Charging us to adopt the provisions that are a national standard because they don't specifically address these. So we think this is a good amendment that we can develop an advisory committee, involve the industry, and come back to Senator Scoy with some ideas about what we should need, if we need to have any legislative changes, or if we can just do it through our rule process with our adoption of elevator code to address these things, address the key points in here are appropriate maintenance criteria, qualifications of the maintenance personnel, because we're finding and the industry's finding that there isn't availability of licensed elevator constructors to be able to look at these, and if we can address the appropriate maintenance criteria for these without having to go through some of the other criteria that will help us in the future. So,
very good. Is there any other discussion or testimony? Yes, we have someone else who'd like to come forward. Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, while the gentleman's coming forward, I want to make sure that the committee understands that we do have every intention in the end of having regulation on new construction. Mm-hmm. And on the elevators that are powered, we're going to look at the regulations that would be required there differently from the manual man lifts. Just wanted that on the record.
Very good. And welcome, if you would just...
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Jim Biagini, and I'm a business representative for the Elevator Constructors Union. I would be opposed to legislation to soften the safety code on any kind of conveyance or elevators. I'm concerned with the workers that ride these units. The industry has spoken that they're used sparingly. I have 30 years in the industry, and I've worked on these units before. The workers there are very inconvenienced when we have the elevators off because then they have to to walk. So I've noticed that they're used pretty much continuously during the day. My concern is, you know, as an industry and as an elevator mechanic, when we walk off a job, we're concerned with the people who come behind us and ride these units. So I did sit on the safety on the committee that adopted the current code 2 years ago in the state of Minnesota. There was no discussion at that time to remove these units from the conveyance safety code. Give you some information regarding are there enough licensed elevator mechanics? I can tell you right now I have 22 licensed elevator mechanics out of work that would be more than happy to obviously go to these sites and look at these units. But the bottom line from my standpoint is my concern is with the safety. of the people that are on site riding these units. And if you look at some of the code, it states that these are limited use units, that only the personnel and the employees of the facility that are trained to ride them are able to ride them. And with that being said, my concern is with their continued safety.
Very good, as is ours. I know that we're very concerned about, and I hope that this is a process where there will be good input and advisory. Senator Skoy?
Yes, and Madam Chair and members, the OSHA regulations that deal with the operator safety will remain in place.
Very good. Any other discussion? So, Senator Skoy, would you like to move your bill as amended? And,
yes,
and is
Madam
this going
Chair.
To the floor, or do we have another committee stop?
I have had no requests for it from any other chair, so I would assume it goes to the floor.
Very good. Senator Skoy moves Senate File 1425 as amended to the floor. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
With that, we have accomplished quite a few things today. I just want to remind our members who are here that we do have committee on Monday. We have a very, very full schedule. So we look forward to seeing you all on Monday. And with that, meeting adjourned.
Sick leave.
Okay.
What's that?
That we're done?
Yeah. For what? She said.
That just means that guy. He has control of it all.
I assume we have a full schedule.